It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. On the show today, we are exploring coexistence. And our next speaker tells us the story of her family. A warning, we do talk about suicide.
We really can't have happiness without sadness. We can't have joy without pain. We also cannot have bravery without fear. Instead of being opposites, those things are teammates.
It took writer Laurel Braitman decades to understand this lesson. But the seeds were planted in her childhood. Quite literally, she grew up on an avocado ranch outside of Los Angeles.
We are about 20 miles inland in a really gorgeous canyon that is lined with fruit orchards. So you can often smell avocados blooming or lemon trees blooming.
Her earliest memories are of her parents teaching her and her brother how to work on the ranch.
You know, pulling out orchards that were failing and planting new orchards, rebuilding the main ranch house, restoring the corrals, and really just rehabbing the landscape in a lot of ways. We helped spread fertilizer and prune, and we would just kind of take breaks and play and then come back and help them.
Alongside those farming chores, Laurel's father also taught them some other life lessons.
But they were really specific skills to, like, what my dad cared about. So, like, all the member nations of the UN, how the Dewey Decimal System worked. He really wanted me to, like, beat men at things that were stereotypically male. That was, like, a thing, a point of pride. So he wanted me to be able to, like, outfish any guy who might dare underestimate me or repair a carburetor or be really good at pool.
These were skills he wanted to pass on because when Laurel was 3 years old, her father was diagnosed with bone cancer. It started in his knee, then metastasized and spread to other parts of his body.
And so from that day forward, we lived between scans. So sometimes we would get, you know, 6 months. Sometimes we would have 6 weeks. The longest we ever had before he had a recurrence was about 4.5, 5 years.
Oh, wow.
So that was a great period of time. But that's how we lived. You know, we tried to fit as much life and memory making and togetherness into those periods of time between therapy or surgery or treatment or scan.
So for most of her childhood, Laurel grew up with a constant feeling of dread, knowing that every one of those lessons and memory-making moments was her father's attempt to make the most of the time he had left.
So another thing my dad did was that he taught himself how to be a beekeeper, and he knew that ancient Egyptians had used honey to treat wounds and for other medical applications. It's a really good natural antibiotic. And because of that, honey that the Egyptians put away is still good, like in some cases, thousands of years later. So he started putting away a lot of honey, like buckets and buckets of honey.
Wow.
And he knew that the honey would outlive him. And I think he hoped that, you know, we would stir it into our coffee or our tea long after he was gone, and we would think of him and we would know how much he loved us. He was so scared and heartbroken that he was going to have to leave us before we were ready, before he was ready.
Mm-hmm.
Amazingly, he lived 14 years with this disease. So he outlived his prognosis many, many times over. And, you know, he always used to tell us, like, when I can't enjoy life with you and your mom and your brother, I'm going to die. Mm. And then I was a junior in high school, and I found a pill bottle, and there was a little note tied around it. There was dosage instructions on the note. And I kind of immediately knew what it was. Suddenly everything clicked into place, and I realized my dad had a lethal prescription. You know, right to die medication was not legal in California, though, at the time. And so I knew I wasn't supposed to know about this. And so I just wrapped it up and I put it back in the cabinet, and then I never spoke of it again. And so that added another sort of dread layer, I'd say, to the everyday, where I knew he had this, but I didn't know when he was going to take it. And he didn't know when he was going to take it.
tell us how it finally happened.
About 6 months later, he and I got into a terrible fight on the phone. I wasn't at home, and I had called home, and he was hassling me about my college applications, of all things. They were due in a few weeks, and he was telling me I had to get them in, and, you know, I was a surly teenager, you know, and I yelled at him, and I was like, I don't know why you're giving me such a hard time. Like, I was so mad, and I hung up on him. And as I was hanging the phone back in the cradle, I could hear him say strongly through the phone, I love you. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, I am not saying that back. He needs to know he's being unreasonable. And I slammed the phone down. And unbeknownst to me, that was the last time we would talk. And the reason he was hassling with me was because he knew he was going to take his medical aid in dying medication. And he knew I was going to be upset and not be able to apply to college. And he wanted to make sure I did it.
Oh.
And by the time I got home, a few hours later, he had taken his medication and he was unconscious and I would never hear his voice again.
That was your senior year of high school?
Yeah, I was 17.
I mean, it's kind of amazing what happened next. You, at least on the face of it, absolutely thrived. You went to Cornell University. You played Division I sports after being an All-American lacrosse player. You were class president. You were a summa cum laude. You wrote best-selling books. Like, you went to MIT for a PhD. Like, you, again, on the face of it, did your father proud.
Yeah, you know, I did. You know, in the wake of his death, I felt so guilty. I lived with a crushing sense of guilt that, you know, someone who was good would not have hung up on her dying father, would have said she loved him. Here was somebody who had sacrificed everything for time to teach me things, you know, like how to beat a man at pool, you know. I felt because of that when it really mattered, I had let him down. Mm. And so I took his dreams from me. And rather than seeing them as like a parent's dreams for their child, like I took them as a literal to-do list. And I went down the list and I was like, okay, he wanted this for me. I'm going to do this. He wanted that. He didn't get to see this place. I'm going to make sure I get to see this place. And I really approached his dreams for me as like marching orders. I dealt with his death by doubling down on the things he wanted for me. And then in my mid-30s, I realized I was just completely exhausted.
Laurel Braitman continues from the TED stage.
I had been living my entire adult life in a way to prove to myself that I was good. I was using achievement and all of the shiny things that come along with it as a way of anesthetizing my own bad feelings of shame, regret, and fear. Those feelings were so big, I worried that if I let myself feel them for even a minute, I would never, ever feel anything else again. But you cannot kill negative feelings, sadly, with work and avoidance. And mine came back with a jolt. On the outside, I was successful and thriving. And on the inside, I was anxious, terrified, and questioning my worth. By avoiding all of the negative feelings, I was muting the fantastic ones too. I was so scared about missing out and losing more of the best things in life, joy, awe, love, wonder, that I couldn't even let myself experience them. I needed to find a new way to be. I wanted to find a new way to be. I had learned that when a young person has a trauma, they can get stuck developmentally at that age of whatever age you were when the hard thing happened. So I was kind of like, you know, a Pleistocene ant in amber, but as a 17-year-old. So I got sort of developmentally stuck in some ways at 17, and I felt like I needed some help moving past that and opening myself up to feeling everything.
I mean, how did you come to that realization? Because you say it took you years to understand that your father expected himself to be superhuman, and by extension, you too. How did you figure out that, like, I mean, that could be the end of the story. And my father died and I took everything he taught me and I had this amazing life. But, you know.
Yeah, if only. I mean, what happened was a little bit harder to understand. And I reached the end of the list and I wasn't happy. Immediately, you know, what I noticed kind of first was that it was getting really, really hard for me to be in relationships. And I really wanted to be in love and I wanted partnership. And when I got close to people, I got really uncomfortable. I think I was just, you know, scared. I to this day, I hate falling in love. You know, it's terrible to love anyone or anything because it can be taken from you. So I did a bunch of stuff. I interviewed a ton of grief specialists and therapists, but what hit me the hardest was becoming a volunteer at a grief support organization for kids. So many of them thought they were bad too. They'd been out of the room playing when their mom died, or they'd said something in anger to an ill parent that they regretted. And I could so clearly see that the painful things that happened to these kids were not their fault. For the first time, I was able to see that that was probably true for me too. By blaming themselves, the kids were making their losses make sense. Even though it hurt to blame themselves, it gave them a reason for the terrible thing that happened, like losing someone they love for no reason at all. Maybe some of you can relate. Often, when we feel difficult things, we blame ourselves because it's easier than admitting we have no control. That's what I had been doing for the 25 years since my dad died. But just because you feel guilt and shame does not mean you did something wrong. Just because you feel regret does not necessarily mean you should have acted differently. It sounds very simple, and it is very hard to accept. But life is nothing except one long sushi conveyor belt of things that are going to test you and teach you at the same time.
What struck you about the way these kids were processing or dealing with losing someone in their life that was different from what you had gone through?
At a center like this, the kids are around other kids who have had similar experiences. And it was a really powerful thing for me to watch. One activity we would do is, you know, draw your grief. And I remember sitting next to one child who was drawing a sneaker wave of grief, kind of like a tsunami. And I remember them getting pretty sad, explaining it. And then 2 seconds later, like they're on the jungle gym, you know, shrieking with joy. And watching that really affected me profoundly because I realized I could do the same for myself, that the hard things could live alongside my joy, that I could be working and I could take a beat and I could let myself have a moment and then I could get right back into it.
What did happy, sad, or this coexistence of two vastly different emotions, or we think of them as being vastly different, what did that look like for you?
I had to learn how to do it. I think I saw the depth of my despair and it scared me so much that I needed to bury it. Mm-hmm. And it really wasn't until I realized that that grief that I had tried to lock away and that was masquerading as self-doubt and as shame and guilt was going to keep me from what I wanted most in life, which is to love other people well and to be of service and to connect with people and places and things. But I will say it's like a daily practice and it comes up in the damnedest ways. So like I have this thing that I can't add someone to my favorites list on my phone or something terrible will happen to them. And so I finally like I think we'd been married for like a year. I like finally added my husband to my favorites list on my iPhone and was like, you can do this, Laurel. It's going to be fine. And guess what? He is still with us. You know, I live in an area too, for example, where wildfires are now a constant threat. And I have to make peace with that, you know? So I was so scared that if I hung the things I loved on the wall, that they would burn down, that I, you know, it would slow me down from grabbing them as I left the house, you know? So this is a daily practice where I have to live with the anxiety and the fear and somehow let my enjoyment and pleasure find a way in around it and through it.
That was best-selling author Laurel Braitman. Her latest book is called What Looks Like Bravery, An Epic Journey Through Loss to Love. You can see her talks at TED.com. By the way, in 2017, a wildfire did reach Laurel's childhood home. The ranch burned down, and she lost many of the structures her father had built to pass on. But
miraculously, the chicken coop survived, which was incredible, and a few other things, including one small shed. And I was going through it, and we found a bucket of honey, like a 5-gallon bucket of honey. And it was fine. It wasn't even smoky. You know, even in the wake of like the devastation of the wildfire, the million other kinds of losses that come for us and had come for me, the honey itself was just perfect, as if it had just been poured in the bucket yesterday. And so now, you know, I don't have any family photos left, or very few, but I have honey.
If you or someone you know may be considering suicide or is in crisis, call or text 988. To reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Thank you so much for listening to our show today. This episode was produced by James Delahousie, Katie Monteleone, and Harsha Nahada. It was edited by Sanaz Meshkinpour, Rachel Faulkner-White, and me. Our production staff at NPR also includes Fiona Guerin and Matthew Cloutier. Our executive producer is Irene Noguchi. Our audio engineers were Jimmy Keeley, Becky Brown, and Zoe Vangenhoven. Our theme music was written by Ramtin Arablouei. Our partners at TED are Chris Anderson, Roxanne Highlash, Alejandra Salazar, and Daniela Bellarezzo. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and you have been listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR.